and surpass meditating in perfect dharma is rarely met with, even in 100,000 million kalpas. Having it to see and listen to remember and accept, I vow to taste the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning. Happy Mommy's Day to mothers and those of us that are cultivating a tender heart, the caring heart, the nurturing heart. You know, on our altar, we always have the Prajnaparamita, which is the mother of all Buddhas. We, you know, not in a historical figure, but an archetypal figure that represents, this is a beautiful depiction, they say based on a Balinese princess, actually. It sits in the museum in Jakarta when Indonesia was a Buddhist country. So, Prajnaparamita, and we'll do a chant to her this morning at the end. Hymn to the perfection of wisdom. So, Prajnaparamita is the mother of Buddhas because it's the practice of prajna. And prajna, what that means, prajna is a practice of emptiness. And as we've been studying in the Heart Sutra, which we'll continue today, is the practice of emptiness is the practice of seeing how everything supports everything else. Or as Norman says, a phrase I like, big love. Everything is supporting everything else. Nothing is outside the circle. So when you practice prajna, you become a Buddha. You recognized your Buddha nature because you are already part of that. You're already part of all of existence. You're already supporting everything, and everything is supporting you. And that is the practice of prajna. So that's why we say Prajnaparamita gives rise to all Buddhas. And then we're going to study, we're going to continue our study. I think it's the fourth lecture. The rest of them, I think, the other three are on our website. Is taught by Avalokiteshvara, or Kuan Yin, or Guan Yin, which became a feminine figure, originally androgynous, but then a feminine figure because it represented this quality of compassion. She is the bodhisattva of compassion. And so today I put her in actually in front in honor of Mother's Day, but in the Mahayana tradition, the bodhisattvas begin to have a representation is almost revered more than the Buddha. More than the Buddha, because the bodhisattva, I mean, if you ask people, they probably would say that, but because the bodhisattva continues to be in the suffering of their, stay with and be able to dance with their own suffering and in the suffering of the world. And that was the quality that increasingly was respected in terms of practice ideology, not to get all chilled out, practice chilled out, and then enter nirvana, pari nirvana, and leave the cycle of rebirth, either on this plane or on whatever plane. They stayed engaged in the suffering of the world. So, and Avalokiteshvara, who's teaching Buddha, actually enters into a deep trance and then says, Avalokiteshvara, you're the one that hears the cries of the world. You are the one that has the sensitivity of the bodhisattvas. Please, you give the lecture on the Heart Sutra. And this is the only sutra in the whole Prajnaparamita, number of Prajnaparamita texts. It's the only one that he gives. So that's significant, actually. And the Heart Sutra, I was thinking, just remembering that the Heart Sutra, I'm going to pause for a second because I need to make two announcements that I'm going to forget if I don't make them now. One is that Patty is going to be giving her Way-Seeking Mind talk on the 10th of June, which is Wayseeking Mind. She's going to tell us a little bit about her spiritual journey and how she got here. A number of you have already given that talk, so she'll be doing that, and I'll send out an announcement about that. And I do believe next week I'll send out an announcement too. Michael Krasny's doing an event either here or there. I don't know why they need both halls, but they told me he won't be able to use this on Sunday, so I don't know if it'll be at my house or at the Sebastopol Center for Arts. And I have to find that out on Monday, and then I'll send you out an email where we'll be meeting. Back to the Heart Sutra. Thank you. So the Heart Sutra was incredibly radical. And it was in the context of what was happening during that time. You know, Buddhism had been practiced for 400-500 years, and then the Mahayana Sutras began to be developed, building on the meditation that people have been doing for 400 or 500 years. And then the Heart Sutra is a condensation of this body of sutras that came forward. The Avalokitesvara Sutra, the Lotus Sutra, the Lankavatara Sutra, these kinds of sutras. And it was incredibly radical what they're going to say. Maybe we'll touch today. We already have a little bit. How radical it was. It was as radical as the New Testament was from the Old Testament. And that's not an accident that this happened about the same time. You know, give or take a few hundred years. Think about that. There was a huge paradigm shift between God as being kind of the vengeful, wrathful God that you're fearful of, moving more to a place with Sermons on the Mount and Beatitudes of love and compassion and turning the other cheek and forgiveness. So this somehow was replicated in Buddhism. Maybe you could say Buddhism led. But it was something happening synchronistically throughout that particular time period. Just another particular time period was probably around the 11th, 12th century when the great number of saints, St. Francis, Rumi, and people like that were expressing themselves. It would be as radical, another way to say it would be if you moved it like, you know, maybe, you know, 12th century Christianity, if suddenly somebody came forward and said, you know, we're no longer going to think about Jesus as God, we're going to think about him as just an enlightened person, and we're also going to eliminate this idea of heaven and hell. That would be pretty radical, right? If somebody tried to do that, probably meet a fair amount of resistance. Maybe even more than Martin Luther King. This is how radical the Heart Sutra actually is when we really start to penetrate it. And you can try, you know, the style of this is philosophical and a little hard to penetrate, because it sort of requires, which I'm trying to give you historically, sort of the historical under and philosophical underpinnings. But really, the way this is meant to be practiced is more as a mantra, as a chant, that you pick a phrase in the Heart Sutra, like, form is emptiness, emptiness is form. What does that mean? You know, no birth and death and no extinction of it. No attainment. You know, these phrases that you can lift out, you don't have to know, you know, what the skandhas mean or what the historical underpinnings of what dharmas meant, which I have been and will continue to explain to you. But this is it's a seminal sutra because, especially in Zen, it's almost impossible to understand where a lot of the Zen koans and where the Zen teachings are coming from, unless you're kind of grounded in where the Prajnaparamita, in where these sutras, this tremendous shift in how they viewed practice, actually. How they actually viewed practice. From a place of more Old Testament, where we were basically, you know, had original sin, we were full of greed, hate, and delusion, and if we practiced, we could eliminate that and we could move into nirvana. And if you really practice, you could go, you know, to heaven here or to heaven in some other reincarnated state. And this shifted to a place of where people began to what was presented was a non-dualistic presentation, that in fact there wasn't any heaven or hell. It was all one thing. It was all merged into one. And then in fact, you already were Buddha. So you continued to do the practice that you needed to do, but the spirit was very different. It wasn't like you have to continually purify yourself. There's something wrong with you, and if you practice, you could get to where it was right with you. It was more like you were there to unveil your basic goodness, your basic unconditioned nature, which was always there. And that's why I started this quote by Suzuki Roshi, because here he is in our time frame actually speaking from the Prajnaparamita, from the sutra. If you remember what he said, at the end of your exhale, you disappear. You disappear. So what he's saying is, in that place, in your meditative practice where the mind can calm, things are unified. It's our thinking process that divides things. Our conceptual mind says, I am I and you are you. I like this, I don't like that. This is eliminating that. And it's eliminated through, you begin to experientially experience this in your meditation practice, where at the end of your exhale, it doesn't have to be, it can be just more easily found sometimes in your meditation practice at the end of the exhale, where you drop away. The mind isn't so discursive. It's not dividing things up. And in that place, you feel the unity. You feel this emptiness. Non-conceptually, you can try to talk about it, but you can't really talk about it, you know? I mean, the Heart Sutra is trying to talk about it, but they, you know, it says this is limited. So this is extremely radical, you know. What this Heart Sutra is presenting, before there was a split, you know, between, is trying to heal the split between mind and body. Before, you know, it was like self-abnegation, where the Buddhist, you know, starved himself. The way you approached your spiritual practice was through ascetic practices. You know, and then you moved into the realm of the spirit. And most, or if not all religious practices, kind of encourages that way to think about it. Well, you still, part of your practice still, isn't to overindulge in the physical material world. That's true. That is part of our practice. But this is saying that no, the material world is not separate. Your body is not separate from your spiritual practice. You're not trying to leave your body, you know, by starving it or denying it to get to a spiritual realm. You enter the spiritual realm, it's inextricably bound up with the material world, with your body. So it's healing this split between the mind-body split. And again, your Buddha nature introduces you to this concept of the Buddha nature, which you're abiding in all the time anyway, whether you know it or not, because you're part of the reality of existence. So that's a little review, which we've done. So the first two paragraphs, or first four or five sentences, are actually the heart of the Heart Sutra. And the rest just kind of re-substantiates it. Avalokiteshvara Bodhisattva, when practicing deeply Prajnaparamita, the meditation that we did, clearly saw that all five aggregates are empty and thus relieved all suffering. That's probably the heart, that one sentence. The aggregates are also, in earlier translations, are the skandhas, which I'll remind you what they are. Shariputra, why is Shariputra brought in? Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness, mind-body. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form itself is emptiness, emptiness itself form. Sensations, perceptions, formations, and consciousness are also like this. Shariputra, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither arise nor cease, defiled or pure, increase or decrease. That's the heart of the Heart Sutra, those lines right there. So let's see. Let me go back and see if I can say a few things about the skandhas. So if you remember, because they come up, these aggregates come up. And so this was the way early Buddhists, in their meditation, the way they tried to analyze how you were, how to try to understand yourself through a meditative perspective. So it was the form, the rupa skandha, and that basically means anything that can be kind of pushed around, you know. Then there was the feelings, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. So again, the eye, the rupa skandha, the ear, the fingers, the feet, make contact with the external world. That's perception. And then you have a perception. Oh, Bonnie, Bob. You have a perception. And then what happens is feelings arise. I like, I don't like, I'm neutral. And a lot of practice, even today, you'll notice that again and again. How many judging thoughts do you have? That's part of bringing the skandhas into view. That's what that means. You know, I really like this. No, I don't like this. No, I don't like this. No, I don't like this. No, I'm a little irritated by that. That's called bringing the skandhas into view. Something makes contact. You have a perception, which is based on your conditioning, your past conditioning. You have a feeling that arises out of that. Now, in your meditation practice, if you don't follow that feeling, like, I don't like that, that's okay. Not much karma results. Imperceptive karma. Irritation, not much if you practice letting it go, which is what you do in meditation, right? You don't sit there in meditation. Actually, you do, but that's what you're training yourself not to do, is like, I really want this, or I really don't want that. So when you notice that, you cut it off, and you come back to the emptiness at the end of your exhale, where you disappear. The self disappears again and again and again. Oop, there it is again. Something comes in. Noise, heat, don't like it. Like it. So then if you concretize around it, which is what we do, I really don't like that person. And these are all the reasons I don't like that person. And then you continue to obsess about that, right? Which we all do. We all know that, right? That habit of the mind. That builds karma. Then karma is building. Suffering is created. And then you go out and you act, because the Buddha said that in the Dhammapada. He says, as the mind arises, karma follows. So as the mind goes, so goes your karma. So, you know, that's early Buddhism, and that's very important. So to bring the skandhas into view are important. Then the next step is what we call a samskara. So samskaras is when you formulate them into deep liking and disliking. Like, I'm just basically angry most of the time, or I'm fearful most of the time, or I'm jealous most of the time, or I just have this incredible greed towards this, you know, I've got to have a half pint of ice cream every evening before I go to bed. That's a samskara formulation. That's your personality is formulated around this. So this is very, and consciousness, the fifth skandha, is what holds it all together. So this was really important work. Buddhist meditators, and even before Buddha, spent hundreds of years observing these samskaras and realizing it was very important to actually bring the skandhas into view, just like we do. We still do this meditation practice, this early meditation practice. So this was really important. But then what happened was they begin to see the limitation of this. They begin to see that some of the meditators begin to see that this it was too intellectual. There wasn't enough of a warm kind of feel, a love that came out of this. It got a little too analytical. Yes, helped you see Buddha's main teaching, which is that you're a tentative formulation. All these khandhas are a tentative formulation. They're impermanent. So that was an important insight. But these meditators later, around 1st century Common Era to 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th century, before Common Era, 1st century to 4th, 5th, and 6th Common Era, began to see that there was some limitation to this. And this is what the Heart Sutra came out of. They begin to see the limitation of just bringing the skandhas into view. So, again, before it was, if I can just perfect these samskaras and get rid of these samskaras, that is what practice is. Now the emphasis is to more to see that these samskaras, even these formulations, are just provisional. Like, don't get so hung up on them. You can use them, but don't get hung up. Begin to see that these samskaras themselves are empty of inherent self-existence, that they themselves are eternity, that they themselves all flow together. You know, that the I is not different from what you perceive or what you conceive and how the consciousness operates. It's all, you can break it up provisionally, but it's all part of one way to look at it. And the result of that is that you can lighten up a little bit with your practice. You begin to see things, less practices like perfection, perfecting yourself, and more of just realizing some basic goodness. So your practice looks very much to the outside like the same, but inside, your attitude really changes. That's why the Lotus Sutra, which is probably the most popular sutra in China, in Japan, Mahayana Sutra, the whole emphasis is not about perfecting yourself. The whole emphasis is about realizing your inherent Buddha nature. So we have that Bodhisattva never disparaging. Remember, we sang the song, you know, the Bodhisattva never disparages. You only see your weaknesses. The Bodhisattva only sees your Buddha nature. You know, the saint, when he looks at a sinner, sees a saint. When a sinner looks at a saint, he sees a sinner. That's the shift. And that's a big shift. So that's why when you hang out with people like the Dalai Lama that are pretty messed up, like I did get a chance to hang out with the Dalai Lama, and there were some people in his entourage that were less than together. And there were these lamas hanging out with him. And then he had a couple of people that were state police bodyguards who were definitely not in the Buddha realm. And he would just treat everybody the same. You know, he could see that this person had a lot of anger or this person had a little more ego, but he wasn't relating on that level. He was relating on a level of your Buddha nature. That's a very different way. And you find that saints, in basically all traditions, not just Buddhism, but they're relating at that difference. They're seeing things at a different level of perception. Very important. So let's see. So the next thing, just to make it a little more difficult for you, I'm going to shift over here to, where's my, here it is. So one way that people organized early Buddhists were the skandhas: form, feeling, perceptions, impulses, and consciousness. The other way that they organized things was by dharmas. Now, dharma is a little complicated because dharma could mean law. It just means the dharma. I'm following the dharma. I'm following the law. But there's like four or five definitions of dharma. That's only one definition. The other definition is it's another way to categorize how you look at the world. So in early Buddhism, and even now in Burma, where I just came from, and Thailand and Sri Lanka, the three main, what they call the three main baskets of study are the Buddha's teaching, what the Buddha actually said in the early Dhammapada and the early books, the Nikayas. The second is the commentaries on what the Buddha said. And the third is what they call the Abhidharma. And the Abhidharma is the study of Buddhist psychology. It's the study of these various states, these dharmic mental states. That's another definition of what dharmic states were. Another way to kind of look at the universe. And this is where there was kind of a radical shift. In the past, when the monks analyzed, there were 75 different categories. There were different schools. Sometimes there were 78, sometimes there were 75. But they had these 75 different categories. Most of them were called the conditional dharmas. Some of them were called unconditional dharmas. The unconditional dharmas were the spiritual dharmas. Like space was an unconditional dharma. Kind of a metaphor maybe for heaven. Nirvana was a unconditional dharma. But even in the unconditional dharmas, there are two types, which my son asked me this question the other night. He was teaching to his seventh grade Buddhism, and somebody asked him a question, you know, he said, well, wait, if you reach nirvana, you know, on earth, where do you go? What's this thing about where you, you know, reincarnation? And so, actually, this is getting a little technical, but in unconditioned dharmas, in nirvana, when Buddha first got enlightenment, he reached this enlightened state where he realized that he was part of everything and everything was part of him. That was part of what his enlightening experience was. But there were still things that he had to work out. The unconditioned is called parinirvana. So when he died, this is one way to look at it, when he died, he extinguished everything that needed to be extinguished. He extinguished all the restlessness, all the greed, everything that karmically propels you on. And he was released. And that's what the definition of nirvana is. It's the extinguishment of greed, hate, and delusion. Anything that propels you into the next rebirth. Or, if you have an angry thought, that thought, if you follow it, is going to propel you into the next angry thought. Just right now, that's one way to look at karma, just on this earth. He'd extinguish that. So the practice, early practice was to continue to work on the conditioned dharmas in the Abhidharma, to continue to try to eliminate them and make them more like your greed, hate, and delusion, to eliminate them. And to move more into the unconditioned dharmas. So that's the way most religions operate, right? You're on this plane and you want to go to heaven. Heaven's the unconditioned dharma. You know, or the enlightened state is the unconditioned dharma. So that was the teaching. So what this began to do is, what he says here is, Shariputra, form does not differ from emptiness. Emptiness does not differ from form. Form itself is emptiness. Emptiness itself form. Sensations, perceptions, formations, and consciousness are also like this. That's the skandhas. Then he says, Shariputra, all dharmas are marked by emptiness. All dharmas are marked by emptiness. They neither arise nor cease, are neither defiled nor pure, neither increase nor decrease. So in this one sentence, they refute this whole idea that conditioned dharmas are different from unconditioned dharmas. They're the same. This is radical. This is like saying, heaven, what you think is heaven, which is the unconditioned dharmas, and hell, which is the conditioned dharmas, are the same. They're the same. Samsara and enlightenment are the same. Life in this, the suffering that you experience in this world is your practice. That's radical. You're not, so it's not like you're just practicing to get away from suffering. It's to really accept and engage the whole package of your life. Can you get that? Can you get how radical this is? You know? Because we're still, in some ways, we practice to get rid of suffering. We practice because we want to feel better. That's one reason we practice. But the deeper meaning of this is a deep acceptance of life, of all parts of life, of all parts of people. I mean, this has happened like in the second, you know, first second. This is a very sophisticated turning of how you view the reality is what's being presented in the Heart Sutra. So, conditioned dharmas and unconditioned dharmas are basically, they're not two different things. So let me read you a little quote here. This is important. And this is the whole basis of non-dual teachings of Zen. So when you start to, I'm going to start teaching some koans, Zen koans. It's impossible to understand Zen koans unless you understand this point. The non-dual teachings of Zen. And this is why the Heart Sutra is so important. And the quote is here, and this is why a lot of the teachers have such good humor about life. How the Dalai Lama can have so much joy amidst suffering. Because he understands, he isn't always out saying, I can only be happy if I correct all the suffering in the world. You can't be happy, and you'll never correct all the suffering in the world. So one part of you accepts the suffering of the world. We call that sort of on an absolute level, because the Heart Sutra is addressing on an absolute level. But remember, we talked that there's a relative level, and the relative level is simultaneously Avalokiteshvara goes out, hears the cries of the world, because she's part of everything and wants everybody to not suffer. So you're simultaneously accepting the suffering, that there is death, and you're going to die, and you do what you can to eliminate suffering. So you're simultaneously working on an absolute level and a relative. Most of us only operate on the relative level. Change that. That's bad. Wrong political party. Wrong person. Wrong part of me. Change it. That's the way that most of us operate. This is a radical change. You both accept it and you change. So Suzuki Roshi, my favorite quote, which you've heard ad nauseum, right? Right? You're perfect just as you are. That's the Heart Sutra. And you could use a little work. Isn't that great? So it's integrating the Buddha nature part, like, yeah, just love yourself. All your flaws, just love yourself. And you do have to practice a little bit because, you know, if you go around hating people and, you know, running them over, that's going to create suffering. So you have to balance both. And that's why on an altar in a Buddhist, often in Buddhist temples, you'll see Buddha, and on one side is Avalokiteshvara, hearing the cries of the world, helping, helping, helping. And on the other side is Manjushri with a sword, saying wisdom. See the big picture. See the big picture. See the big picture. You integrate both of them, and you have Buddha. So. So this is why in Zen, you can say, you know, you go to, somebody goes to Zhajo, the great teacher, and says, tell me about Buddhism. What's the biggest principle of Buddhism? And Zhajo says, in one of the koans, go wash your bowl. No split between heaven. He's expecting some big theory about, you know, the big picture. You know, heaven. That's what spiritual practice is, Buddha nature. He says, go wash your bowl. It's right here. It's right here. Everything you do, every step you take, is your spiritual practice. And that's why we bow, because we're always going around bowing to all the opportunities we have. We're just expressing gratitude to everything. You know, even, you know, we just finished the Lojong teachings, you know, even bowing to people that really bug you because they're your teacher. They're part of your spiritual practice. You can see how, you know, how this moves out. You know, and so we don't wait for some special way outside of our everyday life. That's why you read Joko Beck's book to say, every day Zen. You know, every day Zen. Norman's group is called Every Day Zen. Every day, your everyday life. Or Zhaozhou says, what's meditation? Oh, it's the way to go to nirvana. He says, meditation is alive. It means it's alive. It's whatever is there and you're experiencing, that's it. So maybe that's good for today. We'll give you a little bit about dharmas. And I've got maybe one more sentence after this one. Oh, I'm going to feel like Shariputra. So Shariputra, it was Buddha's disciple that was the most learned in the study of the dharmas. In these conditioned and unconditioned. You asked him, he said, oh yeah, that's in the sixth category of the unconditioned state. You know, I mean, that's how refined it got. You know, he really got it. So Avalokiteshvara is saying to Shariputra, that's great, but it's limited. I want you to see a deeper reality here. You're stuck a little bit in the minutia of this practice. You need to take it to a bigger picture, and that's why Avalokiteshvara is talking to Shariputra. It's also a way that the new schools were saying to the old schools, you know, like the Reformation was maybe saying to the Catholic Church, you know, change. You need to change a little bit. That's basically what's happening here. Okay? So let's end with a chant. Let's end with the heart. Well, let's do this sutra. Well, so I'm going to do this. No, we're just going to chant it because usually if I do a service, I should actually have my robes on it. I have my robes on today. So, Bob, and I'm setting you up. Okay.